grab your prop, charge all the glow take. Curtains going up. 5, 6, 7, 8. We got Big Theater Kid Energy.
Welcome to Big Theater Kid Energy, your least pretentious theater review podcast. I am your host, Ryan Garcia, and I am so excited you are here. This is our first episode. Whether you're on a podcast listening or you're watching on YouTube, thank you for coming. And I want to let you know a little bit of what's coming. We are going to do a review of the show, Am I Roxy?, starring and written by Roxana Ortega, directed by Bernardo Cubría, and that is at Geffen Playhouse. And my guest today is Ben Giroux. Let me do an intro before you even say anything, Ben. Ben is so friggin' prolific as an actor, as a writer, as a producer, as a director, as a voiceover artist. As I think you have a music, too?
Yeah, a little bit.
Oh, my God. I was looking up things about you. A social media creator, appeared in over 100 episodes of television, countless commercials, has a production company by the name of Small Red Cape, and has 4.6 million followers on TikTok. Woo! Ben, what do you got, like 25 hours in your days?
Well, you and I were talking about this actually at the show last night, about how I think in 2025, you have to be a multi-hyphenate creative.
Yeah.
You can't just be an actor anymore.
And no, so I think so true.
You and I both pride ourselves on that.
But I feel like you've been doing that for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this resonates with you, but in the early days of my acting career, I'm a short guy. I was going out. You know, you play one too many Christmas elf or go to one too many Christmas elf auditions in commercials. And it's like, you know what? I think I want a little bit more for my career.
Sure.
So in the early days of playing too many height specific things, I was like, you know what? F this. I want to like start making my own stuff. I want to build a production company. And so, yeah, we've really built Small Red Cape into a pretty solid boutique production company where we make commercials and music videos and TV pilots, and we've got a couple things in development.
It's unbelievable, and it is this thing I remember a while ago thinking, like, this industry owes me nothing. So if I sit here and wait for what it's willing to offer me, then I'm just going to take all the elf auditions or whatever that thing is. Unless I make a choice to put myself out there and show the industry what I can offer. Like, create the image I want to create and tell the stories I want to create.
You really want to feel like you're in charge of your own volition in this town, especially now where things are lean and things have sort of decentralized from LA and there's a lot of people out of work. You want to feel like you're in charge of your own momentum. And I think we can do that as creative people by taking agency for our own, creative careers.
Yeah.
As you're doing with this.
Yeah, dude.
This is the perfect example.
Thank you. I want to talk to you about where you've come to, but let's start with where you came from. I feel like, as we are cut from the same cloth in a lot of ways, I feel like you were, let me imagine for a moment. Were you the lead in a bunch of high school plays?
I was.
Yeah, I thought so. Was there a drama club at your school?
Sort of.
Okay, so I was like, you give like president of the drama club energy.
President of the speech team.
Oh my God. Gosh, of course, yes, you were a speech team guy. Oh,
did you ever
yeah.
do high school forensics?
No.
You would hear forensics and you would think, oh, they're studying crime scenes.
Right.
But no, what was it called? The National Forensic Society, the NFL, actually, league.
That's hilarious for a title.
Nobody could play sports. No, but you would cut down. I remember I used to compete in the humor category, and you would cut down a play or a book or even a film into like this 10-minute speech and debate piece, and you'd go all over the country competing against other funny people. And it was competitive. So there was like judges, and you'd have to go through all the rounds, and sort of like competitive stand-up comedy in a way.
I always thought of the speech team as people that were smarter than me because I was like a big theater guy, but then I look at the speech people and they were just so focused and dedicated and always traveling to the other
speech
competitions.
Well, see, we had it split. So you had those smart people, the orators, and they would like actually debate and they would know policy and they would know all of that. And then you had the theater nerds like me,
right,
who would like, cut down a play and do silly voices and fart jokes.
What was your favorite high school theater role?
Ooh, that's a good one. Dramatically, we did, God, this is probably sophomore year of high school in Phoenix, Arizona. We did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I got to be McMurphy.
Whoa.
Which was fun, because I think at that point I'd never done anything dramatic
before. You just have, like, such a vibe for comedy. I feel like comedy can be so much more challenging than drama that you see a lot of, you know, comedic actors go and do drama very successfully, but it's rare to see a dramatic actor actually be able to succeed at comedy.
You and I know each other from Nickelodeon and doing silly voices together, which is all comedy.
Was there a role you didn't get in high school that you couldn't have been more upset about?
Oh, that's a good one.
I have one. I'll start.
Let me hear it.
I joined the Try Guys, and many people in the Try Guys community already know this, but Keith Habersberger of the Try Guys had just joined Naqua Valley High School, our school, his senior year, and immediately was the lead in every single play. So we were in Wizard of Oz together. He was the Scarecrow. I was the Tin Man. We were in the show The Diviners, a strange play. And then we were in Damn Yankees.
I did Damn Yankees.
You did? Who'd you play?
Well, I've done it twice. I did it in college, and I did it in... Wait, is that true? No, I did Anything Goes twice. Damn Yankees, I was Mr. Applegate.
Is that the devil?
The devil.
That's the role I wanted. And that's the role Keith wanted. Wow, so you and Keith have something in common. You've both played Mr. Applegate. And I had to play Shoeless Joe.
Shoeless Joe lead. From Hannibal Moe.
The first audition I ever did in high school was to play an evil stepsister or an ugly stepsister, whatever they are, in Cinderella.
I, too, have been an evil, ugly stepsister.
I auditioned. I didn't get it. But I got a different role. But I did audition as that because that's just way more fun.
For sure. Although I will say when I was an ugly slash evil stepsister in a panto version of Cinderella that we did at the Pasadena Playhouse, the amount of stuff that you'd have to do before the show in terms of makeup and costumes and all the costume changes, like, it was a brutal performance because of just the amount of extra stuff. Usually, you know, for me, most of the theater I've done, you throw on your shirt and your pants and put a little powder on and you're good to go to run on stage. So that was a challenge.
I hate if I'm seeing a show and people are having dinner at a table and a fork falls off the table and nobody honors it because they're like, oh, it's not my blocking to grab that fork.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
yeep it loose.
Get
you
the
adapt.
Fork off the ground. Be a human.
I remember, I'm sure you have stories like this too from your own theater experience, but I was doing The Miracle Worker in high school.
Oh, wow.
Very serious show. I was playing James Keller, so Helen Keller's, I think, brother. And there's this like really intense dinner scene where they're trying to figure out how to get Helen the help that she needs. And I sit on the chair in the dinner scene and the chair completely explodes and I fall to my ass. And, you know, even in a serious show, you got to sort of riff and like build that as part of the scene. So I remember talking about how faulty the furniture was in our house. I remember doing a panto with my buddy Garrett Clayton. He was like a prince and I was, I don't know, some goofy knight or something. And we're in the woods talking about the princess. I forget what show we were doing. And we had these head mics and his mic just stopped working. So instead of just pretending like all was well, we did the entire scene where he's talking into my head mic.
Wow.
And we played the like very strange and hilarious sexual tension. That
brings in like a... Hey there. So we're alone a lot as 100%. The knight and the squire.
The audience was howling. I mean, it was one of my favorite experiences on set because it was just so, we just yes-anded the moment. So yes.
Okay, quick question. Favorite place to sit in a theater? The orchestra, mezzanine, balcony, box?
I am a first row of the mezzanine guy.
First row of the mezzanine. Okay, good. Now, I asked that question before I could remember. What is the mezzanine?
It's the balcony. The first row of the first
Oh, the first row of the balcony. Great. That's you. That's your thing. First row of the balcony. Like some distance. I do like a little bit of distance, but I want to be in the middle of the orchestra.
Yeah.
Like row F in the middle. Because then, like, you know, if the audience is raked, as it should be, I'm probably like close to eye level with their nipples. And like, but I can see the full stage. I'm not looking up their noses from the front row.
You're thinking like a tall person. I'm thinking like somebody who has had one too many experiences sitting with Amazonians in front of me.
Oh,
and
I
can't see anything.
I hadn't
in fact,
even considered that.
I got to give you this quick anecdote.
Yeah, go ahead.
The first Broadway show I ever saw, I was in New York with my mom on my college audition tour. You know, I was auditioning for Juilliard and NYU and all the stuff that you do when you're a senior in high school. And so we go to the discount ticket place in Times Square.
The TKTS.
TKTS. And we got tickets to Urinetown. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I was in Urinetown in college.
Brilliant.
I love Urinetown. I
played
Mr. McQueen.
Yes, brilliant show. And so we get our tickets and they're like, oh, row 14. Great. That sounds awesome. We're super close. Row 14
like
was the last row of the theater. Which is still fine, whatever. Super excited to be going to see a Broadway show. and the two tallest humans of all time sit in front of me and my mother, who's 4'9", 4'10". And so she's, you know, she's like, well, we can't, this is impossible. We literally can't see anything. So she gets up, she talks to the usher, and she's like, is there anything you can do? And he's like, well, we may have some sort of booster situation we could work out for you. So we're thinking he's going to come back with like a cushion or something we can sit on. He comes back with two plastic McDonald's style, like children's, like toddler booster seats. And she's like, well, this is ridiculous. We're not going to sit in that. And I like, Ma.
It's well your pride, Ma.
I live in Phoenix, Arizona. Nobody knows us here. Like, I want to see the show. Who fucking cares?
Yeah.
So we sat on plastic McDonald's style booster seats. Wow. Had the best seats in the house. I felt like I was on a throne.
Wow.
It was amazing. They were such good seats, actually. And we towered over the entire audience that I remember there was this sort of elderly couple sitting next to us that also requested the plastic booster seats.
Oh, wow. You started a trend.
So the four of us sat there, and that's how I saw my first Broadway show.
Ben, I could talk to you about booster seats and theater and all your history. There's not even time to talk about all the incredible things you've done out here in LA as a director, writer, actor, voiceover artist. Like, oh my God, your voice is rubber. Like, it's unbelievable. Like, your Big Nate voice is one of the things that sometimes I try, like when I'm in the shower, I'm like, can I do that? And no.
I just talk to myself in the shower as Big Nate sometimes, remembering what it was like to have a show.
Wow. But I don't even know that voice makes no sense with your body.
Honestly, the toughest voice was, we did a show called Bunsen is a Beast at Nickelodeon. Probably 10 years ago. Mm. And I had to go on vocal rest for 2 days before every session we did.
Whoa.
Because I was playing Mikey Monroe and the voice was so high pitched for 22 minutes of a show. It was, yeah, you got to adjust that gain on that. You dial that waveform down. I am blowing out your Logic Pro. Yeah, it was full on sucking helium.
Holy shit, that was impressive. Okay, let's jump into the Geffen. We're here to talk about Am I Roxy?
Am I?
Which, by the way, I love. I hope that everyone that talks about this show says it like that. And people are going to say, I'm going to see Am I Roxy? And like, I don't know what show that is.
No.
The show that I think you're talking about is Am I Roxy?
Got to go up on
you
it.
You got to make it a question. Please honor your punctuation. If nothing else.
You know they say in the theater, honor the comma. We're honoring the question.
We were at the Geffen last night, which is maybe my favorite theater in Los Angeles.
Amen to that. I think I told you last night, I don't think I've been to the Geffen in like 10 years. And what a great reminder of what a phenomenal space it is.
It's so gorgeous.
We looked it up while you were there. I think you said it was a 512 seat.
512 seats.
It's a great size.
It feels so much more intimate than that many
seats.
That's
exactly what I was going to say. It feels entirely more intimate than a 500-seater. Great space. And they do a really nice job with an opening night.
Ben, how dare you? They don't just do a nice job with opening night. I think that's the best opening night in LA.
Stellar.
Their rehearsal room is the kitchen and the setup space. And then there's always a DJ or a live band. And it's so friggin' cool. If you have a chance to go to the Geffen Playhouse for an opening night, you have to go. It is my favorite event in the world.
It's they do a really nice job. It's also in like a great part of the sort of downtown Westwood area, the UCLA and everything. There's great restaurants and stuff beforehand. It was awesome.
It was built in 1929 by the Masonic Affiliates Club, the Masons. You can tell. You look at the stonework on that building and it is friggin' gorgeous. What we saw last night, we saw a show in the Gil Cates Theater.
Oh, I didn't realize they had two.
Yeah, they have the Audrey Skirball Kennis Theater, which is right next door, has 149 seats, and that one can become In the Round, it can become Proscenium, it can kind of shift and change. I saw a show there that was like a bar with a stage, The Lonely Few, and it was like a rock band, and it was rocked out. Anyway, we saw Am I Roxy?
Honoring the question mark.
Written by and starring Roxana Ortega.
A Nickelodeon alumni.
Oh, so much to talk about there.
In our Nickelodeon
family. There's
so
much alignment here.
There is.
I have so much alignment also with this show, which we're going to get to.
Honoring the question
mark. And also directed by Bernardo Cubría.
What
Ortega.
A cool name, by the way.
First response to it, I had so many things I related to the show. Like her being a voiceover artist, her being a Hispanic actor, her being a first-generation American who doesn't speak Spanish because her parents wanted her to assimilate.
I heard you audibly respond to that moment.
I was like, mm-hmm.
Yep.
Dealing with the guilt and shame that came with whatever religious and Hispanic upbringing. Her tías, when she had those three tías that she was talking about her aunts, God, that was all my life growing up in Miami. All the aunts having like very strong opinions and so strong personalities and just coming in and like very much a matriarchal society, which is very much what I think was being showcased last night. There was just so much of it that really spoke to me. So before we get into it, what kind of expectations did you have going into the show?
I have produced solo performance theater before, right out of college.
Have you starred in solo performance as
I
well?
I have. I've done two solo shows.
Wow.
It is an unbelievable undertaking that requires some real guts, to just be on the stage alone for that long.
Yeah.
It's a marathon. You know, we were commenting on she had multiple opportunities to sip water last night
and drink and, more, Roxanna,
and didn't really drink much. And I was I was amazed by how little water she had during that experience. But look, I think solo performance is when it's at its best, it's about something that's very vulnerable and personal, which this show was.
So,
and it's about sort of laying bare that vulnerability in a way that there's nothing else you can lean on stage to save you in solo. You know, even in stand-up comedy, we talked about this a little bit, you've got the audible laughter mm-hmm. that you're getting. You can kind of lean into that sort of back and forth with a crowd in stand-up. You know, when you're in a traditional show, you can lean on your other actors if you flub a line or if a prop goes haywire or whatever. When it's solo performance, you are there and it's just you in the audience. And so the level of guts that I think it takes is to be commended, especially with Roxanna's show about something so deeply personal.
And let's talk about what it is, because just talk about it. It's about how she navigated the chaos of finding out that her mother has Alzheimer's and is degrading as a human and really reaching the end, and what kind of responsibility that puts onto her shoulders, and what the relationship is with her mother, and how to adapt in that relationship, and how it changes, and now that her mother has changed.
And how to navigate that, as you said, culturally.
Cultural, inner Hispanic that came out from her. That was like, hey, you better, we take care of our own. Oh, yeah, that really, like, spoke to me. I do feel like I related so much. Like, I feel guilt being so far away from my family. Like, my mom and my dad and my sister, they're all over in Florida. And I'm way over here in Los Angeles. And I'm, like, barely, I see them, what, once or twice a year? And one of the most fun parts of the show is watching her character evolve into this new relationship with her mother that was on her mother's terms. Like, you felt her try to resist it for so long and keep things the way they were. And then when things got most successful within the show is when we got into the fun and games of the relationship, when she decided, what if I just accepted how things are from her perspective?
We just talked about it. It's the spirit of yes and. She finally yes-anded the, without giving away, you know, how the story unfolds. But once she sort of embraced what was happening in the spirit of yes and, like you said, there was this beautiful third act of their relationship and how it unfolded.
And I will say that at the top of the show, and knowing, you know, it's hard not to come into a show with the preconceived notions, but knowing that she's from the Groundlings Sunday Company, Groundlings being a huge sketch comedy improv house out here in LA. A lot of people from SNL had their start at the Groundlings. It's kind of a funnel up into that world. And knowing that she comes from sketch comedy writing and sketch performing, and also, you know, what we do with like the animation for animated acting, should be a little more turned up. I was thinking, like, is this going to have the emotional heft? Or are we going to be in a 90-minute sketch? And I was so pleasantly surprised at the moments of silence and the moments of connection and the moments of vulnerability and how, especially through like the second half of the show when she settled into that, I was so surprised because I really didn't expect that this show that was presented to me was going to hit me there.
Yeah, yeah, it was.
I heard the sniffle. We heard the laughter, obviously, but I started hearing the sniffles around me in the audience as the tears started to pour.
And I thought it was interesting, too. She didn't let too much of the pathos drift into melodrama either, because every time we would have one of those really satisfying moments, she would cut back into her, what did she call it, her inner Latina?
Yeah.
There would be a... I thought there was a pretty good rhythm to punching out of the pathos into comedy again and keeping those waves going.
And I think there's an aspect of this show that's perfect for the first episode of this, because Roxana Ortega has some big theater kid energy. Like, that woman was sustaining a level of energy for that entire show that was unrealistic.
I agree. And I think the thing that stood out to me the most is how precise it was.
Yeah.
It was a very precise performance.
Precise, but then there was like, there's someone in the audience, like, she mentioned a song and someone in the audience went like, uh-huh. And she stopped and went, yeah, right? Like, she was able to honor and play and have fun with whatever
was happening. Present with the crowd, for sure.
With what was happening with the crowd.
Yeah.
But some of those, that ability to have that precision with those larger, hilarious moments. But then one thing about working at the Geffen is that you're always mic'd, regardless, in that big theater. And it's mostly because some of the patrons require hearing aids, and so it's funneling that directly to them, but it's also boosting it to the back of the house. You don't have to project as much. You do have to project, but you don't really have to hit the back row because you are getting boosted, which I have conflicting feelings about. Like, I understand there's a necessary for the audience, but I'm also like,
traditionalist.
I'm traditionalist. I'm sorry. Because of that, it really allowed her to hit some of those more intimate moments in a way that she really succeeded at.
Yeah, I agree.
I think there was so much about this show that was successful. I thought a lot of the Tias and her aunts, a lot of the characters she built were wonderful. I think my favorite moments were when she was in conversation with other characters.
There was a sort of a holistic healer character that was very specific. There was a great impression of her boyfriend, then partner.
Wesley.
Yes, Wesley.
I don't think Wesley's his real name. When she was doing that impression, I was like, I think I might know who that is.
Yeah. But you know, it was a good example of, and I teach this actually when I coach voiceover, sometimes people are like, hey, how do I sound like a different person? And so many people equate that to pitch.
Right.
Or changing your voice in some way. And I don't think, she's a voice actor, but she didn't really have to change her pitch too much with the characters to define them specifically. I thought she just embodied the character point of view and the cadence of each individual character. And there was never a point in the show where I was like, oh, I wonder who she was just there. It was so specific.
Yeah.
But not necessarily vocally, which I thought is a testament to how great of an actor she is.
Yeah. And to that point of what a great actor she is, because, I mean, she carried that show, obviously, so well. And she wrote such an incredible show. Now, there's such a big multimedia facet to the show. There's the two screens plus the projector and the screen behind her that at times had projections that I thought were super successful. Like, sometimes the projections put us in different locations. Part of me wonders, with that multimedia, I was like, I just feel like she was so effective that I didn't need it all the time.
Interesting. I liked it.
You were into it fully. That's such a taste thing for me.
I didn't feel it was too... Sometimes that stuff can be heavy-handed, I think.
Yeah.
But I like those little sweeteners when it is just somebody on stage by themselves. It really helps. It helps me sort of visualize where we are in the story. I will say, if you go even starker than that... sometimes it can't be effective. Like, maybe this is controversial. I just saw Sunset Boulevard in New York about a month ago, and it is a very stark kind of black box version of a classic. And there was nothing on stage to look at or sink your teeth into. And I thought it was too stark. So I actually appreciated in this show the... and it also helped with some of the runners, some of the joke runners. Like, she has a Circle of Life runner where the screens all sort of project the jungle or something, sort of Lion King.
It was the lion. It was not Simba, because we can't legally use Simba, but it was Simba.
Yeah. So I liked it. But I agree with you that if you do too much of that, it can distract.
Yeah, I think you're right. I guess I'm really like, doing this podcast is really going to show me what kind of theater kid I really am. And so far, I'm finding out I'm a purist.
Yeah. No mics, no stage, no props, just actors and a crowd.
That's right. That's all I want, and that's all we need. Okay, one light.
That's it. That's it.
A ghost light and a show.
Yep.
Okay, there's two other things I really want to talk about. One, before we get to that, like, I really did relate to the aspect of her being an actor, and also juggling that, the world we're living in right now, is so divided and dark and scary, and horrible things are happening all over the world and in our country, and it's hard to fathom how we can do anything.
Yeah.
And not feel like it's not enough, or how I can feel like what I'm doing is actually important mm-hmm. or worthy when you start to put all those other things in perspective. I mean, that was one of the themes of the show, of her own journey of trying to be an actor in L.A. became so minimized by what was happening with her mother and her family and her responsibility as a daughter and a sister and a niece. And I feel like I relate to that as well. I think, oh God, this audition is so important, and this could change my life. And then I gotta take that step back, see that bird's eye view, and take in my life in the world, and take a step and look back at the universe. Like, you know, like those photos of the universe or the Earth, is just like, is it a tiny dot?
That spoke to me as well. I remember, you know, for years and years and years, sitting in a casting lobby at Sunset Bronson Studios for a two-line co-star on some random Disney show, thinking like, oh God, if I could only book these two lines, this is going to be my thing. And I think she really spoke to the, you know, it was a show that was appropriate for the LA audience that was there because there were so many people there that could relate to how insignificant so much of the anxiety and the stress. There's a great scene where she's on set for something she booked, which should feel like this huge win.
Right.
And then she's being pulled in other directions because of her mom's deteriorating health. And I think we all have versions of that in our career where it's like, man, you just want to focus on this seemingly important thing, but it's actually not that significant.
And I think it's great because she poses the question and then she poses an answer. One thing I want to talk about in this as well, because I don't want this just to be a puff piece on shows. I want this to be about, like, what can theater do? What is theater capable of? How can theater be effective for an audience, for a night? What is the live shared experience, and why is it worthy and important for us as a society, as a community, as individuals? And one of the things about that is that each show has some kind of promise. And I want to discuss, does that show deliver on that promise? And it felt like the promise of this show was, if you can actually give in to the way that the universe is trying to guide you, or the way that the events in your life are trying to guide you in a certain direction, rather than digging your heels in and thinking, no, I have to stick to my plan, that life becomes so much more easy and fun, and you can still have the things you want, even if you redefine your relationship with them. And that's what I thought this show did so effectively.
I agree. She did that even with the idea of having kids is a big theme in it, and she has to sort of adapt what that means to her
it's
throughout.
It's all about adaptability and about redefining your relationships with people, and also with career, and also with self. And I thought it was really nicely tentpoled by the opera as the place we start at, and that ending had me crying immediately. So I thought, in that way, it really did nail the promise. And maybe you'll agree or disagree, I don't know. But opening nights are different. There's an energy. Sometimes opening nights can be misleading for an actor, because the audience is so on your side and a little bit tipsy sometimes. And so they're like really giving. And it's hard not to let that infect your performance. And not to say that affected hers, but my feelings of like, oh, are we getting into sketch here? Is this show going to have heft? Came from that.
And also, the audience had the same expectations because they know her
background. Right, so specifically.
So I actually thought that there were some laughs at the beginning of the performance that in another performance might not actually be moments that are intended to be funny.
Right.
Because the audience had expectations going in because of who she is. So you're right. Opening night colors a performance in a different way than the rest of the room.
You get this energy, this extra energy joining you on stage. And I really thought that for me specifically, the show settled halfway through and she settled. And that's where I was like, I really got locked in. And I wonder if that's by design, if it's design, because there's a lot of setup to do in every show. And is that setup going to be, it's going to have that energetic heft and push and then settle? Or maybe that was some of the opening night energy that was uplifting.
Because the actor has it too.
And
this
then
is the
exactly.
first time they've done this for, you know, during the run of a show. I don't know if there were previews.
Oh yeah, the Geffen has previews. Yeah. The Geffen gives you plenty of previews, which
yeah,
I love.
Yeah, yeah. But.
But in the previews, you're also changing.
For sure.
So you're
or stopping.
Regardless, you're having a new show the next night. This is the first time this show has been done. 100%. This show wasn't done for previews.
I mean, I think of the shows that I have done as an actor, and the opening night is always a different energy.
Yeah.
Good or bad.
Yeah.
Usually good.
But to that point, once it settled in halfway through, or maybe a little before halfway, I felt, oh, this is amazing. This is... And from there it was like, oh, this is hitting me on all cylinders.
Well, it's a super relatable topic, you know, themes of mortality and what's really important in life. And, you know, obviously there was a cultural component that spoke to you.
Yeah.
But I just thought it's an incredibly relatable topic that maybe is a little uncomfortable for people to talk about. Like,
yeah,
life ends. And that can be a complicated thing.
I think one of the other incredible things that shared live experience can do is one, get an entire group, a room of people on the same wavelength, like breathing the same.
Also, in what other area in the year 2025 do a room full of 500 people shut their phones off for 2 hours?
Unreal. The big question is like, my energy was different when I walked into the space than when I walked out. And I just ask, what kind of chemical change did this have for you walking out of that show?
I think the themes and topics it brings up is something that's uncomfortable to think about for everybody. And I think everybody walked out of that theater thinking about their own life, the people in their life, their family members, and to me, themes of mortality.
For me, the thing that I walked out of it was... life's going to throw hard stuff at you and you can handle it if you are flexible and if you are willing to change.
If you approach it like a groundling.
If you approach it like a groundling and find the fun. You know, and I like that some of the fun she found was childlike. We can have fun and we can find the silver linings. And so I just thought like the way I came out feeling was like, you don't gotta take serious shit so seriously. Serious shit's gonna happen, but you can have fun and you can find a way through it that actually brings you joy. You know, while also honoring that it's hard. But it has to be hard and sad. You know, it can be a multitude of things. I would definitely suggest people go see this show.
Oh, for sure. And look, just going and supporting A, live theater in LA, but also but B, someone who is so authentically showcasing their own story in a really vulnerable, powerful, and funny way.
Yeah.
I think solo performance is an especially niche thing to go support.
And I think that that's one of the important things, too, about this show specifically and what I want to focus on is like, you and I, we are not coming in as critics who don't know what it's like to try to build something. It is, you are working on something right now. You're working on a feature script.
That's right.
And it is hard. And you're also aware that there's that Ira Glass quote about the gap. Do you know this one?
Mm-mm.
So he talks about the gap of what your taste is and what your ability is. So you start out having really good taste and then you see art and you think that's good and that's bad, but then you try to create good art and it's not quite there yet. But how do you get there? It's very easy to try that the first time and discover like, oh, like I guess I'm not an artist because I have really good taste. But if you keep putting the time in and keep trying, then you'll keep closing that gap between your artistic ability and your taste.
And I would also say what developing my feature script has taught me, and in as much as every project I've ever worked on, is taste is subjective.
Yeah.
You know, what appeals to us in this show that we just saw might not appeal to somebody else. And I think that's the beauty of just consuming.
Yeah. Not everyone that's going is going to be a first generation Hispanic man who somehow relates to all the things he's going through. And yet here's one right here who's able to relate to so much from Am I Roxy? From Am I Roxy?
No, but that's exactly right. Like, I could relate to all the themes in it just as much as you, just from a different perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so you have to go see Am I Roxy at the Geffen Playhouse if you are in town, and put the information in the comments and all that down below, and it's still running in the description. And if you're still coming to LA to visit, this is a great thing to do. There is so much theater in LA. You don't have to come here to go to the Hollywood Walk of Fame. I get it. Go look at it. Drive through it. It's just trash. It's fine, but it's just trash. It's a trap. Don't go there. You want to go see rich people's houses? Don't go on one of those buses. I mean, don't go at all. Don't go to somebody's house. They're just trying to live their life. Go to some live events. There's so much incredible food and incredible sports and great, wonderful live theater happening in LA all the time. We're going to go to the big houses, the small houses, to everything. So stick with me. I'm going to keep telling you about what there is to do here in LA when it comes to live theater. But before we go, Ben, do you have any other stuff to promote or talk about?
I've been working very hard with my writing partner, Arnie Pantoja, who was also on Big Nate with us, on a feature film script, because so many of our projects get tied up with giant studios or companies, and you start to lose a little bit of your control or what made it your thing to begin with. And that is a fine process to go through, but we're excited to sort of independently go make a feature and yeah, we'll see where it takes us. But that's going to be our focus for the next
and
6 months.
I
got to
tell
you,
starting this podcast, starting something even like this small potatoes in comparison to putting together a full feature, but it's a lot to do an indie project. Like, I was looking at it up. We're literally 4 weeks from when you and I saw Anne Juliet separately, but really close to each other. And that's when I had the idea. And from then to here, 4 weeks, I've done so much to try to get this thing off the ground. And who knows? I'm going to learn so much. Who knows if this first episode is going to be anything like the 10th episode, which is the point you made to me last night. And so thank you so much for being here as I'm learning what this show is and we're learning together. So feel free in the comments to tell me what you liked or what you'd like to see or what you wish there was more of, because I want to make this show something that's collaborative with my guest, with the theaters in town, with all of you listeners. And I could not have had a better first guest here than you, Ben Giroux, star of stage, screen, and microphone.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for the invite to a great night of theater. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing to take away from this project is, like, anybody who is advocating for going to see live theater in LA, this podcast itself should be supported.
And so go ahead and like and subscribe and do all the things, review, rate, all the things people ask you to do. And if you're looking for us, go to Big Theater Kid Energy anywhere. I've got the website, I've got Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, all the podcasts. Go follow us, go check us out, keep up to date, tell us your recommendations. So excited to have you. So excited to have you, Ben. And thank you all. See you next time. Bye.
We got Big Theater Kid Energy. Look out, we project, we sing out, Louise. Never market, always go full out. John Patrick Shanley never had a doubt. Our voices are warm, fan kicks are high. We've got perfect form. We say thank you, Five. Grab your prop, charge all the glow take. Curtains going up. 5, 6, 7, 8. We got Big Theater Kid.